The engineers at BBN relished opportunities to spook the telephone company repair people with their ability to detect and eventually predict line trouble from afar. By examining the data, BBN could sometimes predict that a line was about to go down. The phone company's repair offices had never heard of such a thing and didn't take to it well. When BBN's loopback test determined there was trouble on a line, say, between Menlo Park, Stanford, and Santa Barbara, one of Hart's engineers in Cambridge picked up the phone and called Pacific Bell. "You're having trouble with your line between Menlo Park and Santa Barbara," he'd say. "Are you calling from Menlo Park or Santa Barbara?" the Pacific Bell technician would ask. "I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts." "Yeah, right." Eventually, when BBN's calls proved absolutely correct, the telephone company began sending repair teams out to fix whatever trouble BBN had spotted. Due to the difficulty of remotely detecting component failures in the geographically dispersed system, the network software grew more complicated with time. Among the basic assumptions made by the IMP guys was that the most effective way of detecting failures was through an active reporting mechanism. They designed their system so that each IMP periodically compiled a report on the status of its local environment, number of packets handled by the IMP, error rates in the links, and the like, and forwarded the report through the network to a centralized network operations center that BBN had set up in Cambridge. The center would then integrate the reports from all the IMPs and build a global picture of the most likely current state of the network. In the first few months, they called it the Network Control Center, but in fact, it was really nothing more than a fairly small corner of an office at BBN, and the network monitoring was informal. The logging teletype was connected via the network itself to all the IMPs in the field, and the terminal clacked away, taking reports from each IMP every 15 minutes. Every once in a while, out of curiosity, someone at BBN would go in and look at the log that was running out of the machine, just to see what was going on with the network. No one had specific responsibility for scanning the log. No one checked outside of business hours, so there were sometimes long periods in which line failures went undetected, especially at night. But if someone at a network site actually called in to say, "Hey, there seems to be a problem," then one of the IMP guys would immediately go look at the teletype log and try to figure out what was going on. Hart's team had designed the IMPs to run unattended as much as possible, bestowing on the IMPs the ability to restart themselves after a power failure or crash. The watchdog timer was the crucial component that triggered self-corrective measures in the IMPs. "The network as a whole did a lot of looking in its navel all the time," said Hart, "sending back little messages, telling us how it was feeling, and telling us what kind of things were happening where, so we could, in fact, initiate work if necessary." Not everything could be diagnosed or restored to working order remotely. There were times when people at BBN noticed that an IMP had just stopped running, making it necessary to reload the software. First, BBN would have to alert someone at the other end of the line and ask him to reinsert a paper tape, or flip a few switches and push the reset button. So from Moulton Street, they would ring the butler bell, the telephone switch box attached to every IMP, hoping to reach someone. Since the IMPs were installed in large, highly active computer centers, there was no telling who might answer. It was almost like calling a payphone. You might get an expert, or you might get a janitor, or some undergraduate who didn't have a clue as to what was going on. Regardless of who picked up the phone, the technicians at BBN would try to talk that person through whatever fixes were necessary. Even people at the sites who actually knew a thing or two about the computers were asked, just the same, to follow BBN's strict instructions. "I can remember spending an occasional half-hour to an hour with a telephone glued to my ear," recalled Cerf, whose hearing impairment made him no friend of the telephone in the first place. "Following instructions from someone at BBN saying, 'Push this button, flip this thing, key these things in,' to try to figure out what had gone wrong and get the thing running again." In a notebook, BBN kept a detailed list of sites, exact locations for each machine, and contacts at the various locations, which in at least one case included the building guard as a resource person of last resort. As soon as IMP No. 5 had been installed at BBN, the team stepped up its testing program to measure network performance and its limitations. Everyone was interested in knowing how well the network would perform under various scenarios, and whether it would stand up to extremely heavy loading. But the BBN engineers were not above becoming testy themselves when Len Kleinrock and others at UCLA's Network Measurement Center would deliberately try to crash the network. The test ferreted out bugs and inspired corrections. Still, one thing was obvious. Under moderate traffic, the network was every bit as fast as BBN had predicted it would be. BBN reported to Roberts that the new network could be described as a taut communication system. That is, messages entering the network showed no tendency to get lost. "We observe that messages do not wander about the net, even at high traffic loads," the BBN team wrote in one of its periodic technical reports. By summer 1970, machines number 6, 7, 8, and 9 had been extracted from Honeywell and were now operating at MIT, RAND, System Development Corporation, and Harvard. AT&T had replaced the first cross-country link with a new 50-kilobit line linking BBN to RAND. A second cross-country link connected MIT and the University of Utah. The ARPA network was growing at a rate of about one node per month. One day in 1970, a delivery truck from Honeywell pulled up to the Moulton Street loading dock and started backing up to unload another new 516 computer. Alerted to the truck's arrival, Severo Ornstein hurried out the door, made a quick inspection of the machine while it was still in the truck, and loudly waved the driver off. Hart, who had come out of his office to see what the commotion was about, stood watching, taken aback, as Ornstein told the driver to turn around and drive the machine back to Honeywell. He was rejecting the delivery. Ornstein had had it with late deliveries and incomplete, faulty equipment. Sending the truck back caused an uproar at Honeywell, he said. But for once, their attention was focused. BBN wasn't accepting another Honeywell 516 until some things were straightened out. The difficulties had been growing. To Hart's team, the relationship with Honeywell felt more like an arm-wrestling match than a partnership. "They kept shipping us machines that had the same old errors in them," Ornstein recalled. After the loading dock incident, he began going to Honeywell regularly to inspect each new machine before it was sent to BBN. Before long, Honeywell had pulled its IMP-building team together and was producing acceptable machines. IMPs were delivered to Lincoln Laboratory and Stanford, and by the end of the year, Carnegie Mellon University and Case Western Reserve University were also connected to the network. By that point, hundreds of minor revisions had been written into the IMP software. Hardware had been tuned and retrofitted. The telephone company, doing its part, now had 14 50-kilobit links installed in the network. BBN's remote diagnostic and network management tools were also undergoing constant improvement. ARPA had extended BBN's contract to keep producing IMPs and run the control center, and it was all clicking. The level of activity in the monitoring center at BBN increased. With the network's steady expansion, the diagnostic reports coming into BBN were starting to bloat and grow cumbersome. The IMP guys were having difficulty staying on top of the data, scanning the printout of the teletype log and locating trouble signs. They needed a housekeeper. So they decided to connect a spare machine, BBN's earliest prototype IMP, to the ARPA network, where it would function as a host machine behind the regular BBN IMP. This new host machine would be used to help process the network status reports. The BBN programmers wrote new code to compile hourly summaries of the more frequent IMP status messages that were now stacking up at the rate of one per minute from each IMP. the code's operative assumption was that no news was bad news. If the network control center failed to receive a status message from an imp for 3 minutes, the network status readout would indicate that the imp was dead. This and other improvements made it easier to detect important status changes in the network. It was November 1970 when Alex McKenzie returned to BBN from a short leave of absence. He and his wife had spent 6 months camping in Europe. In the short time he was gone, the network project had advanced dramatically. Settled back into Cambridge now, McKenzie realized the importance to BBN of managing the network as if it were an electrical utility. That meant a reordering of certain fundamental assumptions would have to occur. The time had come to shift the network from an experimental to operational mode, he reasoned. And McKenzie began pressing that view on all of his colleagues. Organized and meticulous, McKenzie seemed the perfect candidate to take charge of BBN's network control center, and Hart appointed him to the task. Other cultural changes were in the wind around BBN. McKenzie's sensibility about the network project was in tune with a more business-oriented company overall. BBN itself was growing. Within a year or two after McKenzie made his push for running the network as a utility, BBN had bought the Superior Laundry at the busy end of Moulton Street and torn it down to make space for a new seven-story headquarters building. Eventually, the network control center and the rest of Hart's division moved to the fifth floor of the new quarters. Architecturally, the style of the impressive new building subtly suggested a sleek fortress. Built at the height of the anti-war movement in the early 1970s, it reflected BBN's emerging corporate consciousness about anti-establishment threats to companies engaged in U.S. Defense Department contracting. The building had no windows on the ground floor, where a large computer center was located. It also had a basement parking garage designed so that the building itself stood back, surrounded by a substantial, waterless moat, allowing access to the front door only over a short footbridge. On the fifth floor, the network control center occupied one large room with large plate-glass windows, looking north to the hills beyond Cambridge. Hart's team, numbering about 30 people, was spread out in modern offices and well-equipped labs throughout the floor. Hart's division had the only floor in the building with its own tiny kitchenette tucked off a central corridor, a special request by Hart, who intended to equip it with a restaurant-quality Italian espresso machine someday. Dominating one large wall of the control center was a logical map of the network. Constructed of movable magnetic pieces on a metal background, the map was a wiring diagram showing all of the imps, host computers, and links, indicated by square, round, and triangular markers. Color codes and pointers indicated the status of each imp, node, and link. At a glance, operators could tell which lines or imps were down, and where traffic was being routed around the trouble spots. Besides critical information, an occasional joke or cartoon might be tacked up with a magnet as if the control map were one big refrigerator door. One of the NCC's primary tasks was to issue software upgrades and reload IMP operating programs when necessary. The operators used a cleverly cooperative scheme by which every IMP downloaded the software from a neighbor. Every Tuesday from 7 to 9 a.m., BBN had the network reserved for software distribution, network testing, and maintenance. Within these 2 hours, operators in the NCC would have every IMP on the network running a new software release. All new versions of the IMP operating codes were eventually distributed this way. The process of electronic propagation would begin in Cambridge as a new software program was downloaded to a nearby site, which in turn would download the software package to another neighbor at the command of the operators. The method also had restorative potential. If an IMP's operating program were found to be destroyed, the IMP could send a request for a program reload to a neighboring IMP. The responding IMP would send back a copy of its own program. Other big changes had also taken place in the network's second year. BBN and ARPA decided that the ruggedized Honeywell 516, reflecting too much worry about reliability, was an expression of overkill. It was expensive, too. The 516 cost roughly 20% more than a newer version of the computer, the Honeywell 316, which was not available in ruggedized form. Ben Barker, who remained intimately involved in maintaining and troubleshooting more than a dozen IMPs now in the field, actually concluded that the cabinetry on the ruggedized 516 was a source of reduced reliability because it hampered what should have been easily performed routine maintenance tasks. Honeywell was under contract to handle routine maintenance. But here, too, they were slow in coming around to BBN's emerging view, McKenzie's utility model, of how a computer network should operate. There were periods in which the downtime of the IMPs averaged as much as 3 or 4% on a monthly basis. If an electrical utility or the telephone system were down that much of the time, a day out of every month, its performance would be considered abysmal. But Honeywell had to be coaxed into picturing where BBN and ARPA wanted to go with the network. "I remember a great meeting when we went over the numbers with the guys at Honeywell," Barker recalled. "The Honeywell guy said, 'Wait a minute, you're saying these machines are down between half an hour and an hour a day? That's like, 3% downtime. You mean these machines are up 97% of the time on a 24-hour-a-day basis? How are you doing that?" The 3% downtime that amazed Honeywell was, in BBN's words, prolonged hardware failure syndrome. The normal procedures of calling in and working with Honeywell field engineers had not cleared up several of these persistent failures, reported BBN. They were particularly concerned about problems at several sites in the Washington, D.C. area. Frustrated by recurring maintenance problems, Roberts threatened, ever so vaguely, to cancel BBN's contract. Barker eventually went to Hart and proposed letting him put together a BBN-directed maintenance team, with an adequate field staff for periodic maintenance and a roving expert firefighter. But McKenzie adamantly opposed the idea. Not because he was content with how things were going with Honeywell, but because he feared that Barker would only make things worse. It was Barker's slovenly personal style to which McKenzie, a fastidious man, was reacting. He said Barker's office looked like a garbage truck had been backed up to it and emptied of its contents, and indeed it was a fitting image. Few would dispute that Barker's office was, on a good day, a total mess. Nor would they dispute the sharpness of his technical knowledge and skills. So in trade, Barker made a concerted effort to keep his office clean, and Hart handed him the job of building and directing a crack maintenance team. Maintenance aside, Hart's own confidence about the network's intrinsic reliability had grown in the first year. He had seen the IMPs functioning successfully in the field. His team had met its initial tests. He was also a little more relaxed, after a while, about the trustworthiness of the on-site investigators and graduate students. As a consequence, the last ruggedized version of the Honeywell 516 rolled into Moulton Street around the end of 1970 and eventually was shipped as IMP No. 15, headed for the Burroughs Corporation in Powley, Pennsylvania. At about the same time, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign received Machine 12, which had been delayed. By now, BBN had received ARPA's go-ahead to shift into another intensive engineering effort, designing a prototype 316-based IMP. Honeywell promised delivery of the machine in early 1971. The transition to the lighter 316 IMP was only part of a developing structural shift in the ARPA network. For months, Hart's team and Roberts had been discussing the possibility of connecting many new users to the net without going through a host computer. It appeared they could make it possible to log on to the network, reach a distant host, and control remote resources through a simple terminal device, a teletype or a CRT with a keyboard, directly connected to an IMP. the new scheme would eliminate the need for a host computer between every user and the IMP subnet. All you'd need to make it work would be a dumb terminal connected to an IMP. This would open up a lot of new access points. If it could be worked out technically, then hundreds or even thousands more users might gain access to the network without physical proximity to a host computer. Then, the network would no longer be just an experiment for the hardcore computer scientists with mainframe accounts, but open to a whole panoply of more casual users – military officers, government bureaucrats, university administrators, students – who would be brought into the networking community. That would bring the world one step closer to realizing Licklider's vision of the computer as a facilitator of communication and human interaction. But neither the original IMPs nor the new 316 IMPs could support more than four host interfaces. Neither machine could accommodate a terminal connection. To make the new concept workable, Hart's team would have to build a new interface that could handle dozens of terminal lines feeding into the IMP and the network. Sensing the value of going in this new direction, BBN launched an accelerated effort to design a terminal controller that could manage the traffic generated by a large number of terminal devices, connected directly or through dial-up lines. The new device was called simply a Terminal IMP, or TIP. Within 6 months, BBN and Honeywell completed the design and construction of two new prototype machines based on the 316. The first was a basic IMP, the other a TIP that included a multi-line controller capable of managing the signal traffic of up to 63 terminals at once. All terminal devices attached to a TIP would be addressable as if belonging to a single host on the network. In the back room where BBN took deliveries, Hart's team had set up a small test cell to debug the incoming machines. The last of the 516 machines had been coming in the door at a fairly steady pace every 4 weeks, and at any time there might be two or three machines, sometimes more, linked together to test their performance and simulate network traffic. The first four deliverable TIPs were scheduled to arrive at BBN by late summer of 1971. Everything seemed to be working according to design. BBN began exploring the gamut of terminal devices that might be connected to the network. The options ranged from graphic CRT displays to slow and fast line printers to alphanumerical displays and teletype-type terminals. The team was also considering how to link to card readers, magnetic tape recorders, and other peripheral devices. Still more routing algorithm tests, throughput tests, tests of flow control schemes and remote diagnostics tests continue to occupy the BBN team on a daily basis, week in and week out, leading to steady improvements in their packet switching technology. The network control center kept expanding with the network. Pressure to maintain the network grew. It became a steady part of ARPA's contract with the firm, and soon the center was staffed around the clock, 7 days a week. At one point, the NCC upgraded some equipment and added an automatic phone dialer to the system. The auto dialer was intended specifically to monitor the condition of modems spread throughout the network. There were dozens of modems handling data traffic to the TIPs. The BBN troubleshooters had the auto dialer run a simple test. The dialer was programmed to call each modem once a day and listen for an answer. If a modem picked up and whistled back, its vital signs were considered normal. Any modem not answering or signaling back improperly turned up on a trouble report. At one point, the NCC staff picked up on a particular modem that appeared to be malfunctioning whenever the autodialer ran its check. Someone suggested placing a call through the autodialer to the troublesome modem while a technician listened in. Perhaps he could diagnose the signal coming back. So he placed the call, listened for the modem to pick up, and heard an angry voice on the other end of the line. Before slamming down the receiver, the voice is reputed in countless retellings to have said, "Hey, Martha, it's that nut with the whistle again!" Congestion control, one of the troublesome problems demonstrated by Kahn's experiments, had been attacked and improved. BBN had redesigned the scheme to reserve enough space in the IMP memory buffers for reassembly of incoming packets. A specific amount of reassembly space for each message would be reserved at a destination IMP before the message would be allowed to enter the network. The sending IMP would check, and if told that there was insufficient space available in the destination IMP's buffers, the RUFNUM, request for next message, was delayed. The solution was not unlike the treatment many an airline passenger has experienced when a plane cannot take off because bad weather at the destination airport prevents the plane from landing. The passenger sits on the ground and waits for an opening at the destination. In simulations, the new scheme succeeded in preventing the insertion of more traffic into the network than the destination IMP could handle. If development of the network was to proceed at a steady pace now, closer coordination would be necessary between BBN's effort to introduce the terminal IMP and the network working group's effort to develop protocols. So, Hart's team decided to involve itself much more deeply in the work of the network working group. By mid-1971, BBN had injected itself into the NWG's committees. Mackenzie was the BBN representative, working on the host-to-host protocol, the file transfer protocol, and the Telnet protocol. Although it took more than a year to work out, the Telnet protocol was a relatively simple procedure. It was a minimal mechanism that permitted basic communication between two host machines. The first four nodes had connected four different machines, while other host sites offered a further melange of incompatible computers, ranging from the DEC PDP-10 to large IBMs to Honeywell and Xerox machines. Telnet was conceived in order to overcome simple differences, such as establishing a connection and determining what kind of character set to use. It was TIPS and Telnet together that paved the way for rapid expansion of the network. File transfers were the next challenge. For a couple of years, a half dozen researchers had been trying to arrive at an acceptable file transfer protocol, or FTP. The file transfer protocol specified the formatting for data files traded over the network. Transferring files was something of a life force for the network. File transfers were the digital equivalent of breathing. Data inhale, data exhale, ad infinitum. FTP made it possible to share files between machines. Moving files might seem simple, but the differences between machines made it anything but. FTP was the first application to permit two machines to cooperate as peers instead of treating one as a terminal to the other. Bringing this functionality to the network depended on the FTP working group coming up with a working final product. The chairman of the group, Abe Bouchon, an MIT graduate student and systems architect, was an expert in MULTICS, an ambitious and complex operating system. Bouchon had studied problems of multitasking in a single computer. The next step was to eventually transfer blocks of data in a multi-computer system like the ARPA network. In the 6 months it spent working on the file transfer protocol, the team usually met face-to-face in regular sessions of the network working group. But it also frequently used real-time computer teleconferencing. Members of the team would all log on at once, from Palo Alto and Cambridge and L.A. and Salt Lake, and for an hour or two at a stretch trade comments back and forth. Conversing through keyboards and terminals was less spontaneous than speaking, but Bouchon believed it forced clarity into their thinking. It also had the advantage of creating a record of their work. In early July 1972, the final touches were put on FTP, and John Postel, now the editor and distributor of the requests for comments, released it as RFC 354. The only real problem with this network now was load. That is, there wasn't much of it. At first, traffic was light because the protocols were late. Now, on a normal day, the channels were virtually empty. In the fall of 1971, the network carried an average of just 675,000 packets per day, barely more than 2% of its capacity of 30 million packets a day. The UCLA Network Measurement Center continued generating test traffic to probe the weaknesses of all the network algorithms. But there wasn't enough natural traffic on the network to really push the limits of the routing and anti-congestion schemes. There were some interesting early uses. Programmers at SRI were using Utah's PDP-10 compiler in preparation for installing their own PDP-10, and they generated the most actual traffic. John Postel at UCLA was using the network to run SRI's online system. Bob Metcalf, a Harvard graduate student working at MIT, and a friend, Danny Cohen, who taught at Harvard, did one of the more exciting early experiments over the network. Metcalf and Cohen used Harvard's PDP-10 to simulate an aircraft carrier landing, and then display the image on a graphics terminal at MIT. The graphics were processed at MIT, and the results, the view of the carrier's flight deck, were shipped back over the ARPA network to the PDP-1 at Harvard, which also displayed them. The experiment demonstrated that a program could be moved around the network at such high speed as to approximate real time. Metcalf and the others wrote up an RFC to announce the triumph and titled it Historic Moments in Networking. Others weren't so successful. There was an early attempt to devise something called a data reconfiguration service. It was a failed attempt to write a programming language that would interpret incompatible files on different computers. The ARPA network, however, was virtually unknown everywhere but in the inner sancta of the computer research community. And for only a small portion of the computer community whose research interest was networking, was the ARPA network developing into a usable tool. To them, it was a fantastic experiment, but you had to be involved in things like queuing theory or communications theory to appreciate it. If, on the other hand, your work was in artificial intelligence, or robotics, or computer graphics, or almost anything else the community was investigating, the utility of this grand transcontinental packet switching system had yet to be realized. No one had come up with a useful demonstration of resource sharing. The protocols to make it work weren't even in place. The ARPA network was a growing web of links and nodes, and that was it, like a highway system without cars. Yet, ostensibly, throughout the community there were rich resources to be shared. Carnegie Mellon had a premier artificial intelligence department, and unique applications attendant to it. Stanford had an extraordinary robotics group. Theoretically, at just about every site, some unique capability could be contributed to the network. If the network was ever to become anything more than a testbed for the artificial traffic generated by the network measurements and network control centers, word of its potential had to be spread. Larry Roberts knew it was time for a public demonstration. Roberts was on the program committee of the first International Conference on Computer Communication, to be held in Washington in October 1972. He circled the date and called Bob Kahn, who was still at BBN, and asked him to organize a demonstration of the ARPA network as the sole exhibit at the meeting. The conference was about a year away. Roberts asked Kahn to start planning immediately. Kahn had in fact already been planning to leave BBN and go work for Roberts at ARPA. But both men decided it would be a good idea for Kahn to stay at BBN for a while to plan the demonstration. Kahn's first move was to recruit Al Vezza of MIT's Project Mac to assist him. Vezza always made a good impression. He was sociable and impeccably articulate. He had a keen scientific mind and first-rate administrative instincts. Between the two men, there probably wasn't a key computer project in the U.S. research community they didn't know about, or a key player they couldn't persuade to join them. In mid-1971, Kahn and Vezza called a small group of about 8 principal investigators from around the country to come to a meeting at MIT's Tech Square in Cambridge. They presented the idea of a highly accessible, engaging demonstration of the community's most interesting resources, accessibility over the network. Vezin knew it would have to be a live, interactive demonstration if it was going to have any impact. Someone at the meeting argued strenuously in favor of a videotaped presentation to ensure against computer crashes during the show. Vezza was incredulous and argued just as strenuously that anything but a hands-on, live demonstration using actual equipment and software would signal uncertainty and potential failure for the whole ARPA network experiment. It had to be done in real time. It had to be something that could be touched and controlled by anyone just sitting down at a terminal. It was a gamble. There still wasn't much operational experience with the Telnet and file transfer protocols, which the participants would have to employ. And this increased the risk that the demonstration would fail. But if the demonstration succeeded, it would prove the network was not only real but useful. For the next 9 months, Kahn and Vezza traveled the country on Roberts's budget. "There were lots of blind alleys," Vezza recalled. They met with dozens of vendors in the computer industry, asking each to participate by bringing its own terminals to the Washington Hilton, where the meeting would be held and where a tip would connect them to the ARPA network. Roberts was arranging for AT&T to bring 2 50-kilobit lines into the hotel. The plan was to run demonstrations on as many machines as possible, connected to as many sites as possible. Organizers would invite conference-goers to come in, sit down, log on, and use the network's resources. Dozens of meetings took place at the various network sites to design interesting scenarios. Teams of graduate students and principal investigators signed on, and almost as soon as they did, they began to feel a certain panic. To pull this off, they would have to step up their efforts to finalize the unfinished network tools and protocols. Roberts, ever so correctly, had foreseen the likelihood that scheduling a highly visible public demonstration for October 1972 would build pressure on the community to mobilize and make sure the network would be functioning flawlessly by that date. Kahn, too, acknowledged that the demonstration was set up to force the utility of the network to occur to the end users. In the fall of 1971, BBN had a prototype tip running at 50 Moulton Street. Two other tips were operational elsewhere in the network, at this time consisting of just 19 nodes. The tips, based on the Honeywell 316, were completely compatible with all of the older 516s. By early 1972, several additional 316 IMPs and tips had been installed and the central part of the network between the east and west coasts was beginning to fill in. By August 1972, a third cross-country line had been added. In addition to IMPs scattered around the center of the country, there were now clusters of IMPs in four geographic areas: Boston, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Los Angeles. As the ICCC demonstration approached, there were 29 nodes in what was now being widely referred to as the ARPANET, or more often, just the NET. And people at the sites were madly scrambling. Dozens of major contributors from throughout the U.S. academic and research communities had become involved. Intensive efforts were underway to debug applications and get host computers up and running in time for the public demonstration. Every terminal manufacturer had been invited to prove its equipment could work with the ARPANET. They were lining up to show more than 40 different computer terminals in the demonstration. Vezza negotiated with a local vendor in the Washington, D.C. area who agreed to lend a large section of anti-static, raised computer room flooring for installation in the meeting room at the Hilton, where the tip and terminals would be located. AT&T promised it would come through with the data link. Getting such a circuit installed anywhere in less than 6 months was no small issue, and it certainly wasn't a small matter for AT&T to have that line into the Hilton as the ICCC approached. Several days before the meeting, the networking equipment and people began arriving at the hotel. Kahn and Vezza had drawn up a floor plan. The tip was located up on a section of raised flooring in the center of the large meeting room. Around the perimeter of the room were to be the dozens of terminals, virtually no two alike. It would take a couple of days for all the gear to be moved into place, connected, powered up, and checked out. In a matter of hours, the room was a teeming tangle of wire and people speaking technical jabber. Technicians were stretching cables everywhere. Members of Hart's team were all around, tools in hand, deeply engaged in helping the various terminal manufacturers modify the connector cables on each of the multitude of terminal devices, so that each could be connected to the tip. Hours were spent stripping wires, rewiring the connectors, reconnecting, testing, and debugging. Many of the participants were working at a fever pitch. Many had packed up while still finishing their projects and came to Washington to add the final touches. It was the first time the whole community showed up in one place at one time. "If somebody had dropped a bomb on the Washington Hilton, it would have destroyed almost all of the networking community in the U.S. at that point," observed Kahn. Not to mention the international community, for even Donald Davies, father of the term packet switching, had come over from England to see how this would all work out. "It was just an amazing experience," said Vint Cerf. "Hacking away and hollering and screaming and saying, 'No, no, you got this one wrong!' Getting all the details right." At the end of Saturday, the conference opened on Monday, the BBN tip was like a king on a throne of wire, running to all corners of the room. AT&T had done his job and turned up at the right moment with the right line. Sunday was another frantic day of preparation, but now the tip was in action, so people were starting to run programs and do their final checkouts. Many didn't finish until late Sunday afternoon, just before a preview demonstration was scheduled for a group of VIPs, a Washington coterie of congressmen, Pentagon officials, and others. At about 6 o'clock in the evening, minutes before the doors were to open, Vezza was standing near the tip when Metcalf said, with no faint urgency in his voice, "We're losing packets." Vezza shot a look to Mackenzie, who was standing right there. "Alex, what changed?" Mackenzie reached for the hotline to Cambridge and shouted into the phone, "Get it out! Get it out!" The Network Control Center had been watching and monitoring a slightly glitchy line in the network for the past few days. They thought they'd solved the problem that afternoon, and had added the circuit back into the network. Within 30 seconds of Mackenzie's call, the link was removed by the operators at the NCC, and packets were flowing smoothly at the tip again. BBN's remote management technology had never had a finer moment. Later that evening, John Postel was in the exhibition room sitting at a keyboard, logged on to the host at UCLA. His team had designed a demonstration in which someone in Washington could pull up a file in Boston via the host computer in Los Angeles. The idea was to then print out the file in the exhibition room at the Hilton. When Postel shipped the file to the printer sitting beside him, nothing happened. He looked around the room. There were a lot of other demonstrations, one of which was a small robotic turtle built at MIT. The turtle was built to demonstrate how a computer program could be written to direct the motion of a machine. Kids could write their own programs in the Logo language that said, "Go left, go right, go forward, back up, move sideways." And when the program was run, the turtle would do that. At the moment, however, the turtle was jumping up and down, twitching and jerking crazily. Instead of sending Postel's file to the printer, the system had accidentally sent it to the turtle port, and the robot dutifully offered its interpretation of what it took to be motion commands. As an enthusiastic graduate student, Bob Metcalf had undertaken the task of writing a booklet to accompany the demonstrations. It described 19 scenarios for using the ARPANET, listed resources at various sites, and showed how to log on to a remote host, how to gain access to one of the applications, and how to control a program or engage in some kind of interactive communication over the network. There were several chess games, an interactive quiz about the geography of South America, a way of reading the Associated Press newswire over the network, and many other games, tools, and demonstrations. One of the more practical applications simulated an air traffic control scenario in which responsibility for monitoring an airplane flight is automatically handed off from one computer to another, representing different air traffic control centers as the plane crosses geographic boundaries. Metcalf's Scenarios book was designed to walk participants, most of whom knew little about the ARPANET, through each demonstration step by step. On Monday morning, the ARPANET computer scientists eagerly awaited their public. When curious conference-goers approached, the network guys, like Jehovah's Witnesses handing out copies of the Watchtower, thrust Metcalf's Scenarios book into their hands and ushered them into the room. Although it was possible to follow the instructions, to all but the initiated, the Scenarios book was fairly incomprehensible, and it was easy to foul up the system. One man sat down in front of a terminal and typed in an instruction from the book. For some reason or other, the host he was trying to reach wasn't functioning, or he miscued the thing. The message came back, "Host dead." "Oh my God! I've killed it!" he exclaimed. He wouldn't touch a terminal after that. Other funny things happened. Two people had logged in to the University of Utah. One saw that somebody else he knew but had never met was logged in. They were in talk mode, so he typed, "Where are you?" The other replied, "Well, I'm in Washington." "Where in Washington?" "At the Hilton." "Well, I'm at the Hilton, too." The two turned out to be only a few feet from each other. Some things weren't so funny. As the author of the Scenarios book, Metcalf was chosen to take 10 AT&T executives on a virtual tour of the ARPANET. It was an odd sight. Young Metcalf, with his big red beard, showing 10 AT&T pinstriped businessmen around the network. In the middle of the demonstration, the computers crashed. It was the first and only time the computers went down. The phone company executive's first reaction was to laugh. "I looked up in pain," said Metcalf, "and I caught them smiling, delighted that packet switching was flaky. This I will never forget. It confirmed for them that circuit-switching technology was here to stay, and this packet-switching stuff was an unreliable toy that would never have much impact in the commercial world, and now they could go home to New Jersey. It was clear to me that they were tangled up in the past." Had they looked beyond the luckless Metcalf and the failed demo, the AT&T executives would have seen the exuberance in other corners of the room. Not only did packet-switching work, but it made wondrous things possible. Some of the most ingenious demonstrations involved English-language conversational programs. These were elaborate programs constructed to engage a user in a verbal dialogue with a machine. There were four programs on display, two of which offered an especially fascinating glimpse into interactive computing. Parry, the first of these virtual conversationalists, mimicked the belief system of a paranoid psychotic. He held up his end of the conversation by offering canned responses to statements he thought he understood. Otherwise, his response was noncommittal. Parry was the brainchild of Dr. Kenneth Colby at Stanford University. The Doctor was another conversational program, based on ELIZA, a natural language program written by MIT's Joseph Weizenbaum. The Doctor, which mimicked the behavior of a psychiatrist, was rather more diffident than Parry. The Doctor accepted statements, then tried to produce new sentences based on the words and syntax of the other conversant. While the resulting conversation was altogether banal, users were often struck by how lifelike the quality of their conversations with the Doctor actually seemed. "People would sit down and interact with this thing," observed Cerf, "and sometimes they'd ask other people to leave the room, because they thought they were having a private conversation." Cerf and others had toyed with the idea of setting up Colby's paranoid to have a session with the psychiatrist. Just a few weeks before the ICCC demonstration, Parry indeed met the Doctor for an unusual conversation over the ARPANET, in an experiment orchestrated at UCLA. It perhaps marked the origin, in the truest sense, of all computer chat. There was no human intervention in the dialogue. Perry was running at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab, the doctor was running on a machine at BBN, and at UCLA their input and output were cross-connected through the ARPANET, while the operator sat back and watched. "Good evening," said the doctor. "Tell me your problems. Please terminate input with a period or a question mark." "People get on my nerves sometimes," Perry replied. "I am not sure I understand you."
"You should pay more attention."
"Suppose you should pay more attention."
"You're entitled to your own opinion."
"What makes you think I am entitled to my own opinion?"
"It bothers me just to be around people in general."
"Please, go on."
"I went to the track at Bay Meadows a while back."
"Why do you say that just now?"
"There's a lot of crooked gambling going on there."
"Please, go on."
"I gamble on horses."
"What does that suggest to you?"
"I went to the races."
"What else would you like to discuss?"
"Gambling has been nothing but trouble for me."
"Why do you say that just now?"
"I've had experience with crooks gambling at the track."
"I am not sure I understand you fully."
"Do you know anything about bookies?"
"What makes you think I know anything about bookies?"
"A bookie didn't pay me off once."
"What does that suggest to you?"
"I beat up the bookie who did not pay off, and I thought he might use his friends in the underworld to get even with me."
"Who are you really talking about?"
"Have you ever really thought about the Mafia?"
"Suppose you ever really thought about the Mafia."
"Let's talk about something else."
"I am not sure I understand you fully."
"You keep asking me the same things. Why not change the topic?"
"Why are such questions on your mind?"
"I thought I told you. People get on my nerves."
"Your nerves?"
"I would rather not discuss that anymore."
"Would you like to discuss your nerves?"
"I guess so."
"I am not sure I understand you fully."
"You harp on the same questions too much."
"What does that similarity suggest to you?"
"I don't get you."
"Do you wish that you didn't get I?"
"It's about time you showed some interest in my feelings."
"Oh, I showed some interest in your feelings?"
"I will help you if I trust you."
"Do you wish that you trust I?"
"Maybe yes, maybe no."
"You don't seem quite certain."
"In my opinion, you have a one-track mind."
"What makes you think I have a one-track mind?"
"I used to go to the track every week."
"What else would you like to discuss?"
"That's something I don't want to go into."
"Why do you say that just now?"
"It's none of your business."
"Why are you concerned over my business?"
"I don't confide in strangers."
"Don't you really confide in strangers?"
"Let's change the subject."
"I'm not sure I understand you fully."
"What's wrong with you that you keep on bugging me about this?"
"Please, go on."
"You are a real nag."
"Does it please you to believe I am a real nag?"
"I have had enough of this."
"What does that suggest to you?"
"Goodbye."
"It's been my pleasure. Fear equals 4.2223001. Anger equals 10. Mistrust equals 12.650703. That's $399.29, please." Hundreds of people participated in the ICCC demonstration over its 2.5 days. Executives, engineers, and technicians from the telecommunications and computer industries, a good number of them, entered the room skeptical of the ARPANET and packet switching. Many left believing that technology might be real after all. For the most part, the 40-odd terminals worked, the resources were engaging, the tip ran spectacularly, and the ARPANET came alive.
It was almost like the rail industry disbelieving that airplanes could really fly until they actually saw one in flight, said Kahn. The ICCC demonstration did more to establish the viability of packet switching than anything else before it. As a result, the ARPANET community gained a much larger sense of itself, its technology, and the resources at its disposal. For computer makers, there was the realization that a market might emerge. The sense in that room was not one of fear or concern, said Len Kleinrock. It was excitement. I mean, here we could show it off. We knew it would work. Even if it fumbled, these things were fixable. It was a wonderfully exciting experience. Roberts had shown steady confidence. He had gotten what he wanted, a more solidified effort, the foundation for a community, something he could build on. The crash efforts and panic that preceded the event had paid off, and on this day even BBN and Honeywell were getting along. Bob Kahn had just devoted a year of his life to demonstrating that resource sharing over a network could really work. But at some point in the course of the event, he turned to a colleague and remarked, "You know, everyone really uses this thing for electronic mail." Chapter 7. Email. One September evening in 1973, Len Kleinrock was unpacking his bags when he discovered that he'd forgotten his razor. He'd just returned home to Los Angeles from Brighton, England, where he'd left the razor in a Sussex University dormitory bathroom. An ordinary electric razor, it was no big loss. But it was mine, he recalled, and I wanted it back. Kleinrock had just come from a conference on computing and communications. The conference had brought together scientists from several countries, some of whom had begun developing digital networks under the auspices of their own governments. But the U.S. government's ARPANET was by far the largest and most sophisticated network experiment in the world, and the international community welcomed the chance to see the project demonstrated. The organizers of the conference had also decided to use the occasion to test the transmission of data packets via satellite. For the conference, a temporary link from the United States had been patched into Brighton. Packets traveled over a satellite link from Virginia to an earth station in Cornwall at Goonhilly Downs near Land's End, and from there a dedicated phone line was installed to connect with the University of London. From London, a final hop was patched into Brighton, where people had a chance to use the ARPANET just as if they were sitting in an office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Menlo Park, California. Kleinrock had returned to the States a day early, so when he realized he'd forgotten his razor, he thought he might find someone still at the conference to retrieve it. There was a handy bit of software on the network called the Resource Sharing Executive, or RSExec. If you typed in "where so-and-so," RSExec would look for so-and-so by searching the Who list, a roster of everyone logged on at each site. You could locate a person on the network this way if he happened to be logged on at that moment. I asked myself, what maniac would be logged on at 3 a.m.? Kleinrock remembered. He went to his terminal and typed, "Where Roberts?" A few minutes later, Kleinrock's terminal displayed the answer. Larry Roberts was indeed still in Brighton, awake, and at the moment connected to a BBN host in Cambridge. A teletype number for Roberts also appeared on Kleinrock's screen, enough information for him to tap his colleague on the shoulder electronically from L.A. "All I had to do was make a teletype connection to BBN," said Kleinrock. He linked to Roberts using Talk, which allowed them to converse by typing onto one half of a split screen while reading from the other. The two friends traded greetings. "I asked him if he could retrieve the razor. He said, 'Sure, no problem.'" The next day, the razor was returned by Danny Cohen, a mutual friend who had been at the conference and had come back to L.A. There weren't any formal rules restricting use of the ARPANET by those with authorized access. Kleinrock's razor retrieval caper wasn't the first time anyone had pushed past official parameters in using the network. People were sending more and more personal messages. rumor had it that even a dope deal or two had been made over some of the imps in Northern California. Still, tapping into the ARPANET to fetch a shaver across international lines was a bit like being a stowaway on an aircraft carrier. The ARPANET was an official federal research facility, after all, and not something to be toyed with. Kleinrock had the feeling that the stunt he'd pulled was slightly out of bounds. It was a thrill. I felt I was stretching the net. The ARPANET was not intended as a message system. In the minds of its inventors, the network was intended for resource sharing, period. That very little of its capacity was actually ever used for resource sharing was a fact soon submersed in the tide of electronic mail. Between 1972 and the early 1980s, email, or network mail as it was referred to, was discovered by thousands of early users. The decade gave rise to many of the enduring features of modern digital culture. Flames, emoticons, the at sign, debates on free speech and privacy, and a sleepless search for technical improvements and agreements about the technical underpinnings of it all. At first, email was difficult to use. But by the end of the 1970s, the big problems had been licked. The big rise in message traffic was to become the largest early force in the network's growth and development. Email was to the ARPANET what the Louisiana Purchase was to the young United States. Things only got better as the network grew and technology converged with the torrential human tendency to talk. Electronic mail would become the long-playing record of cyberspace. Just as the LP was invented for connoisseurs and audiophiles, but spawned an entire industry, electronic mail grew first among the elite community of computer scientists on the ARPANET, then later bloomed like plankton across the Internet. It was about the time Kleinrock was reaching for his razor that taboos were tumbling and the tone of message traffic on the net started loosening up. As cultural artifact, electronic mail belongs in a category somewhere between found art and lucky accidents. The ARPANET's